thanks to Masoma for sponsoring the first series of The Making Of. Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Masoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative, and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Masoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on masoma.com. You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives. But don't worry, I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest today is the FGM activist and author, Nimco Ali.
I always say that FGM was painful, but the real pain came from well-meaning people. Nobody actually ever said, are you okay? Nothing, not even a hug.
She is the co-founder and CEO of the Five Foundation, which is a global partnership to end female genital mutilation across the world. She's also author of What We're Told Not to Talk About, But We're Going to Anyway. Nimco is an absolute force of nature who has spent the last 10 years fighting a courageous battle to end FGM. We had a very varied conversation, which was quite emotional at times, taking in everything from shame, race, mothers, and even exorcisms. So, here we go. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about your six defining moments, or six moments that shaped you. The first moment you've chosen is when you had FGM.
Yeah, so I had FGM when I was 7. That is the fundamental factor in basically my life for the last 30 years. I don't know who I would have been without FGM, in the sense that I lost my innocence. I lost the ability to actually live life without any pain or any kind of fear of like having peace and security and everything. So everything was like super temporary in my concepts and in my mind with that. And because it also happened around the time of the civil war in Somalia, so there was just all this like, you know, destruction of losing all the sanity and security that I had. I think that has been a fundamental thing in my life, in the sense that I've always kind of stood alone, because if your parents can be part of that, if the people that you look like can, like, you know, start a genocide against you just because of your bloodline, like, what does that actually mean to, like, really love and trust people? So, yeah, so that was my defining moment.
And before then, you had been living in the UK and then you went back to Somalia for a short time, right?
Yeah, but it's like, so we'd been living in the UK between UK, Hargeisa and Dubai. So my dad was based in Dubai when my mother and him got married. So we were like constantly traveling. And the reason why we'd go back to Somaliland was that my mother would get pregnant every year and she wanted to have her children with her mum around. So I was very familiar with Africa. I was very familiar with traveling. And I think it's like I had until about the age of 6 and a half, and then when the war broke, and instead when I had the FGM, I had no awareness of, like, this is the thing, I had no awareness of race, I had no awareness of gender, I had no awareness of, like, how privileged I was, because I think that's what privilege does for you, it gives you a bubble.
Right.
So when people talk about white privilege, I'm like, no, I think all of us can be extremely privileged and insulated from realities that people face, because it's just not our day-to-day thing. It's like, I would try hard every single day to make sure that my niece is insulated from a lot of the things that I've experienced, be that FGM, like racism or whatever it is. So privilege doesn't necessarily have to be about race. It's about the opportunities and the realities in which you live. And so literally I had no inkling as to inhumanity in the world. So that was, yeah. So I had like a really bliss life and I was a complete utter brat, and I was kind of proud of that brattiness. it was something that I got from the fact that I had no fear and I had no limitations in terms of who I was and what I could be.
And your mum and your grandmother, you said, had fostered that kind of confidence in you, yeah, even though they were responsible for the FGM that happened to you when you were seven.
Yeah, so they gave me, so even beyond the, after the FGM, they gave me the ability to be really free, because it took a lot of work for me to do in order for me to understand that that my mum had very little control over the situation. And also, which is really weird, was like, I ended, like, last, so a few years ago, when my granny died in 2018, I'd gone to see my mum, who was in Somaliland at the time, and her sister, her younger sister, who's the one directly after her, was sitting around the table. And they started talking about, she said something about FGM. And then she said, I bumped into Aisha. And do you know what? The world is such a mysterious place. So at the age of 13, in order to regain control over my anatomy and my body, I named it Aisha.
Oh.
It was just a name that I kind of liked. And then 28 years later, I find out that the woman who subjected me to FGM was called Aisha.
That is weird.
So I was like, who are you talking about? And my mum's like, oh, the cutter. So there's this really weird, like, loving relationship that they have with the woman that has, like, you know, performed this act, because she was also the woman that delivered me. And it was like,
so right.
And my friend Jaha, who is an incredible Gambian activist, has a similar relationship. If you see her film, she has this, like, that, like, her and her cutter, like, talk about her mom and everything else. So that's something that I never had, because I just thought, like, this is just painful and crazy. And I hated her anyway, because I remember seeing her face and just, like, thinking, you really are not somebody with a nice face. That I found, like, really fascinating. So I've kind of learned that my mother and my grandmother, God rest his soul, had a very complicated relationship with the realities of FGM, and especially in the context of a civil war happening, it was as though this is the last thing they can do for me to learn about my culture as a Somali woman,
right?
And that was just what they did. But I remember it's really fascinating when you start having conversations with people. So one of my friends was having a conversation with her mum, and she said to her mum, but you just did it out of ignorance.
Mm.
And there's a Somali word called eel, which is like basically saying, I wouldn't be able to live with myself, but out of anger, not out of, like, thinking eel. So it was like, I would be so angry with myself if I didn't do it. And that word is so powerful that it shows that there was, like, actual malicious intent. And this girl was like us. She was living in the UK before the war broke out. Their mother, knowing there was a war happening, brought them back to Somalia to have FGM, and they got stuck in Russia for 6 months.
Oh my God. Okay, so at that point, at this point, you've got to explain to me, what is the power of FGM that would make a mother do that, to, you know, go back into a war zone and obviously subject her daughter to a lot of pain that she knows she's going to experience? What is the power of it that makes people do it? Women do it.
It's fear. And I think that's what I mean by this Somali woman saying eel, which basically it's like, it's the most powerful emotion that is like anger and determination. So she would not be able to live with herself if she did not do it. So it's this control and power and shame, and it's consciousness of these women thinking that if I don't do this to my daughters, they're not going to be like me and I'm going to be judged by everybody else. And that's one of the things that I realized about my mum. I always used to say that if my mum and I were not related, we wouldn't be friends. If she was like a young girl and I was a young girl, we would not be friends, because my mum is the epitome of a Somali woman and she's a people pleaser.
But what was her fear for you? The idea that if you didn't have it, what did she think the outcome would be for you?
I think like rejection is very Rosemary's Baby kind. I think it's rejection and not the ability to kind of to identify as a Somali woman, because they tie their identity so much to what everybody else thinks. And everybody knows your business. I'm like, why do people know my business? Like, how are people going to know, like, if I've subjected my daughter to FGM or not? So it is a cult mentality.
Right.
And men will say, oh, like, and it's really interesting, because like the men, like my grandfather, God rest his soul, my great uncles and everybody else were very much against it. But it was the women that were like, I'm not going to be an incredible woman unless I do that. Because the ideal of the Somali woman was a woman who was cut, who was everything.
Right.
You have to aspire to that. It's just the same reason why we spend our time either dieting, plucking our eyebrows, whatever.
Right.
It's set by the culture. So FGM is at 98%. Like, everybody does it. It's like nobody's saying, like, oh, it's a choice to do it. It's so ingrained.
Right.
That there is no space to not to think about it.
And you said before, when we've spoken about this, that it's also to do with, it's like there's a financial element in some ways, because you're worried that your daughter won't be able to marry.
Yeah, marriage is the only opportunity which you exist within that society, or you're able to, fulfill your dreams. So you get married and you have children who then get married and have, even though my mother said, I wanted to become a teacher, I wanted to become a nurse, there's these ideals of what jobs they wanted, but never actually looking at that to be paid.
Right.
The first, it's really interesting, like the first cohort of nurses that were trained for Somaliland in the UK, they all came back and everybody expected them to work, but they were like, but you have husbands, so why do you need to get paid? And that wasn't dissimilar. So like, you can be a maid at work because you're so poor, nobody married you. And so it was similar to what was happening here in the UK in, like, you know, in the 1900s. Mm. It's the idea, the fact that if you're married, why do you need a job other than a hobby?
It's interesting that you say that this is the first moment that made you, because when you've spoken to me about this before, you've said that almost one of the points for the patriarchy of FGM is that it does break you.
The first thing the patriarchy does to you to initiate you into womanhood or into your gender is an act of pain. What else can they do if you put your head above the parapet?
Right.
FGM is fundamental to who I am today, but it doesn't define me.
Mm.
It's like, it's one of the things where I think had I lived a life uninterrupted at the age of 7, like, I don't know what my potential could have been. And it is like, you know, in a way, like, it hasn't fully broken me. It's like, I have to see it as a part of my identity. I have to see a part of it as my lived history.
Yeah.
Just as the war had made my parents refugees and lose all the wealth that we had, and then meant that my life was completely different, so has FGM, like, changed the course of my life, because I'm sure it would have been completely different had I not had FGM. So, like, the relationships I had, the eating disorders, the everything, like, you know, the struggles I've had as a result of coming to terms with that. But at the same time, it hasn't created the fundamental fear of me not to put my head above the parapet. So in terms of making me, said, I always say it's tried to break me, but it made me the loudest person in the room. FGM was painful, but the real pain came, again, from well-meaning people, where like the nurse and the doctors that saw my infibulated anatomy just were like, oh, well, this is like... interesting, well, we'll give you some medical help, but nobody actually ever said, are you okay?
So no one offered to give you counseling or anything like
that? Like, even a social work, nothing, not even a hug. And I remember that's why I ended up turning to food as my crutch,
right.
And then turning into, like, you know, turning to bulimia as my emotional stress kind of thing, because it was one of those things where I was awoken to the fact that what happened to me was wrong and I was wrong, but everybody else around me was like too consumed by other things or too consumed by not to offend, to not do anything.
Because you also told a teacher, didn't you, when you came back to the UK?
Yeah, when I came back, because again, I've got this other thing that Somalis say is called Bilahishod, means no shame. So right. I was like, yeah, this happened to my vagina. And she was like, wow, that's like, I think she was taken aback. I will give her the credit of, like, you know,
right.
of 30 years of hindsight, thinking that to have a 7-year-old come to you and tell you something so graphic is quite, like, it's taken, it will take you aback. Because even to this day, I have teachers that say to me, oh, but, like, what do I do? And I was like, call the bloody police. That's what you need to be doing. Like, you know, stop assuming that brown and black people don't actually abuse their kids, because, like, FGM is abuse.
Right.
Even if I had a social worker, and I got a social worker, they would have found that my mum was a young woman who was out of her depth.
And when you talk to your mum about this, what does she just, I mean, have you gone into it with her, like, really talking about, like, why did you do it and how did you feel about doing this to me?
I haven't gone into depth recently, because what happened was that, like, you know, when I was first starting to be an activist, I think that was a massive emotional disconnect between my mother and I at the age of 11. Right. And then my grandparents came to the UK, and I just did what I always did, was like, I superseded my mom for my granny. I was like, okay, fine, I don't even need to talk to you. And I was completely one of those kind of things. I was just like angry and living through that kind of anger. And then when I started the activism, even though I was doing it from a position of like, I want to be able to make things better, it was also a position of being very like hurt. So I was still articulating and arguing a lot of things from the position of a 7 and an 11-year-old. Mm. And my mom was like really like embarrassed and angry that for 30 years, or almost 30 years, that she'd done so much for me in spite of the FGM, like, you know, just to apologize without saying I'm sorry, because she hasn't gone through that emotional process herself, but I was just throwing everything back in her face.
Right.
Like she would stand up for me when some Somali men in the community will say, your girl's too westernized, like, look what she's doing, like, all these things. Even when she knew that I was probably, like, you know, doing things that were un-Islamic or not something, she didn't make it such a big issue. And then after a while, it became, because I was doing it so publicly, it became as though I was like throwing things back in her face. And I kind of understand that I was well behaved until I was about 26. I was like, okay. Then I became the, like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to wear what I'm going to wear. And this is basically who I am.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories.
Who are the kind of people that were giving you death threats?
Like my cousins. Like,
wow.
It was like people that I knew. So that's why it was so...
But why was it? Because you were shaming them, or because they really didn't want people to stop FGM?
Exactly. I was shaming them. And also, if people start talking about things like FGM, what else are they going to organise and talk about?
Okay.
And it was this whole... And also, it was this idea of the fact that I was telling a secret to white people. And what I found really frustrating was women on the left in the traditional women's movement saying to me, oh, I'm demonizing already marginalized community. And I was like, no, I'm talking about the humanity of women and girls. Because, like, nobody wants to talk about it, FGM and violence against women and girls. Like, growing up, my FGM happened so early that by the time I was in primary school and high school, like, I didn't see many in my high school because I moved to a different place. But I saw girls that were getting forcibly married. Like, I know, like, there are girls that I went to primary school with who are 37 now, like 20, like 21-year-old kids. It's like, there was like so much happening to brown and black girls in my like local community that nobody cared about, because heaven forbid that we offend the kind of the Somali or the Pakistani or the Bangladeshi community. And I was thinking, like, I didn't know her, but there was the girls that were in my school and my primary school then till the nearing secondary school that, like, you know, set herself on fire. And again, there's another brutal way which people like killed her, because she was getting forcibly married to a man she didn't want to be married to. So there's like all these, like, there was like trauma all over me, and all, like, you know, the left were like, let's not offend the Somalis, they're being traumatized by a war.
Can you just explain, like, the arguments that you would be getting from some liberal feminists about how to deal with FGM? Their position was that you shouldn't get involved, like, and that it wasn't wrong, or that it was wrong but you shouldn't criticize.
It was wrong, but I shouldn't call it violence against women and girls, because violence against women and girls actually it happens within a construct of, like, you know, patriarchy. And I was like, stop acting like white people invented the structure of patriarchy. It's like, and the fact that FGM happens unconsciously, as though you just go with it. You have to do several, like, to get a girl out of Cardiff and to get her to Dubai to have FGM, takes several moments of conscious things that you have to do. So that's what I mean about the micro racism of well-meaning white people, as though I hadn't sat around, read Noah Al-Salawi, done my research, and understood that FGM was an organized crime against my gender and against my humanity. Saying that actually blew their mind. It's like, mate, I don't need to tell you what FGM is. I'm going to deconstruct it for you. And that to them, me being smart was like, a hindrance in this activism and this campaigning. They wanted me to be the black woman that came and told her story and cried. And I was like, so that's why I cried at home, because I was like, I'm not going to cry in front of you, even though I'm so frustrated.
And do you feel like they brought you out for things to be that kind of, like, you know, FGM witness, but you wanted to be more?
I refuse to talk about the brutality of FGM and all these things. I wanted to talk about it being violence against women and girls. We need to, like, you know, really make it illegal and really use the legislation to do things. But I was, like, demanding humanity. I was like, this is not an African issue. This is a British issue. Let's talk about it here.
Right. Okay. I'm going to go on to the second point. But there's so much more to talk about this, but we'll kind of get it into the other bits as well. So the second moment that made you is when you lost your grandma.
Yeah.
So when did that happen?
Ooh. January 2018.
Oh. This is still very new. Oh, Nimco. Do you want to talk about it? Are you sure?
We can kind of, because it was it was basically my greatest fear. And I think it kind of pushed my mother and I together, because I wouldn't have that crutch of always like thinking, like, because I think it just kind of brings the generation closest together, because it's like, it's my mum, and then it's me, and then it's Sophia, so there's nobody else. And my grandfather, God rest his soul, once said that you don't grow up until you lose your parents. So, anyway.
Oh, it's a bit sad, this one. Oh, Nimco. We don't have to talk... We could not talk about this one.
Yeah, I think it just created a lot of humanity, in the sense that I think as children and as daughters specifically, we never end up seeing the flaws in our mother, and I think that's what it did. Anyway, yeah. We're just as bad as Yeah, I think the positive thing, which is another moment in my life, is that it made me, like, have love and respect for my mum.
Because your grandma and you had a different relationship than you'd had with your mum.
Yeah, and that was like, and I think she gave me that. And I think it's just so in our culture, in our community, that you can't question, like, you have to love your parents unconditionally. And I think that's problematic, because not every parent is perfect and not every parent is actually good for you. So the idea of saying, oh, like, it's really interesting. It's like, I have a different relationship with my dad, which the fact that I decided not to have a relationship with him, but I decided that I was going to help my mom and my brothers, like my brothers, to have a relationship with him. And it's really interesting. The only people that have an issue with me saying that I don't respect my dad are deadbeat dads. Because they're always conscious about the fact that, oh my God, I can't believe you don't have a relationship with your dad. It's always people that it wakes something in them. But I think, dramatically, in sense of like women having issues with their mums, is very socially unaccepted. So the idea, the fact that if someone says, oh, I don't talk to my mum, you think, oh my God, like, what the hell, like, how can you not talk to your mum? Or somebody saying, oh, like, you know, yeah, my grandparents, in this like very dismissive way of like, I'm like, my God, but they should be the cornerstones of your life. So I think culture like can really influence our life. And then for me to even say that, I remember saying to my Somali friends, and this is what they were like, oh my God, you're such a brat, you're so British. I used to say that I want my mum to apologize to me. So I have the girls, the irony is, the girls I've always had the most issues with, the Somali girls I've always had the most issues with, I've always had toxic mothers that I've known, but they've never been able to address that. And me saying I wanted my mum to apologize to me, they were like, who the hell do you think you are? Like,
right.
That pushback, the same as from these, like, deadbeat dads. And it's like my granny dying and my grandmother telling me about my mum,
yeah,
how happy he was, like, when I was born and all that kind of stuff, really made me question that if I had a child at the age of 20, I would have just been like, I think I would have been a hot mess, and really understand that my mother as a human being can be flawed and she has the right to be flawed. So I think seeing my mum through my grandmother's eyes has made me realise that actually maybe I was the one that was being irrational, and also I was the one that had gained a privilege where I was able to work through my shit to a certain extent.
So the third point you have is learning to love your mum. So that kind of part of that, it comes from your grandmother, like you said, and then what else happened?
And also just like, just basically getting over myself and thinking how hard it must have been to be like, you know, in your mid-20s with all these kids, the country of your birth falling apart, having seen destruction and yet just like having to raise these, like, you know, this vocal daughter. So I think that's what it was. It was like, that love came from a place of real respect, not because I fear going to hell, which everybody does if you're religious, because like in our in our faith is like heaven lies at the feet of your mum, is basically the thing. So like, you know, damned is the one that questions their parents. So, and me going against my parents and all these other kind of things was like, was not cool. But learning, and that's what I meant. I chose to love my mum. I chose to be friends with my mum. I chose to call her. I chose to do all these things. And I do think seeing her as human and as vulnerable because of the death of my grandma really changed that.
What's part of the resentment that you had towards your mum to do with FGM? Was that where it mostly came from?
Yeah, I think it was the FGM. I thought, like, you know, not understanding that her breaking up with my dad was nothing to do with her, it was him. I think it was a lot to do with that, because I remember the first time, like, when my mom told me she was getting divorced from my dad, I don't think I understood it. Okay. She just told me, and I was just like, because she was the only person that was there, I ended up blaming her for a lot of the things that were going wrong in my life, rather than actually really blame it in the fact that there was a civil war. My dad chose what he chose and he could have acted differently, like a lot of other men did.
So in your family, who was the first woman to not get FGM?
So it's my niece in my direct family, so she's 9, and Suhaila is in my first cousins in the UK, but my other cousins in America haven't been cut either, they're 16. Even today, I, like, you know, there are girls who are educated, grew up here, who be like, oh, I literally can't deal with the idea of my daughter not being cut.
Right.
And I'm thinking, like, what is, like, what does that, like, say? So I think they should be psychologically supported to get to the point where they understand that what happened to them was wrong. And, like, you know, let's actually look at the triggers and everything else, because it is, it's like, it's something that you rationalize yourself with, but the fact that, oh, talking about FGM means that you're someone like me, rather than saying, oh, you're just anybody that doesn't care about, like, that cares about humanity.
Yeah. And they're brainwashed.
Yeah, they're brainwashed. And it's always a lot easier to accept something than to fight it. So to normalize it and rationalize it than to actually say, oh my God, this is wrong. I need to deconstruct. I need to build my life beyond FGM or outside of what FGM is. It's hard to just say, oh, well, like, it's fine. Let me repeat it again and again.
Your fourth moment is when you went back to Somaliland.
Yeah, I went back in 2016. It's really funny that Hargeisa is the only place, and Manchester are the only place I've ever been uncut. Like, I've lived both places. Because, like, I didn't have FGM in Somaliland. I had it in Djibouti, so I don't have any, like, connection to it. And again, it was another one of those things where, like, my grandparents had moved back there, and I just thought, you know what, I thought if I stay away and my granny dies when I'm away, then it means, like, oh, like, it's not my fault, like, you know, because my grandfather ended up dying when I was in Burkina Faso, and I remember it was 2014, and I remember getting about like 72 missed calls on my phone and thinking, fuck. And then my sister saying, I just didn't want you to find out on Facebook.
Wow.
So, and it was then, and then it was also kind of like, so in 2014 was like when I was in the pit of my activism, like the real kind of like stuff we were doing, international development stuff. Mm. And also the time that my mother and I were in the darkest place in our relationship. And then I remember, because I was thinking like, I never ever in my life, and I never would intentionally like, you know, go out to hurt my mom or to embarrass her, to do any of these things. Even if I was angry and I would kind of like do things in my head and like whatever it was, I would never do that. I've never done that. And that shows like the level of love and compassion I have for her. And I remember in 20, just before my grandfather died, so this reporter came to me and she's like, oh, can I buy you lunch and we'll talk about your FGM? And I'm like, great. It was in the Times. So I'm like, any of the people that, and this was almost 2 years after the Evening Standard article came out, with the first article that I ever did, which got me the death threats and everything else. And I thought, they don't read, like, nobody that hates me read the Times. So it's like, fuck them. It's like, this is like a great strategy and this story needs to be told. And then the guy goes to me, can I just take a picture just to illustrate it? I was like, that's fine. It's going to be behind a paywall anyway. Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
I go out and we're in this bar and the Sky News review comes on. And front page of the Times, Nim Kowali's face.
No.
With like, I don't blame my mum, she was so stupid.
No.
And what I meant was like, what she did was stupid as a kid. Like, not like, I was coming to, like, so my mother's in like Somaliland there because her father's about to die. I'm on the cover of like one of the biggest selling newspapers calling my mum stupid. Well, obviously
what,
so
what did she do?
She had like a total meltdown about like, you know, like how insensitive I was and everything else, blah, blah, blah. And then my grandfather like dies when I'm on a work trip in like West Africa. And it was and then I thought to myself, like, why am I getting, like, so I was so broken, but then I was also visiting an orphanage that time, that day. And it was, there was these kids who had nobody.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like having this like thing of saying, my God, how dare I like be upset that my grandfather that I've had for almost 30 odd years of my life is dead and these kids have nobody. And this woman, and her words would always stick with me, she was like, your pain is your pain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if this is what's hurting you, it's like these kids don't know, like, you know, any difference, and you can, and at least you're having empathy for them.
Yeah.
And then I thought to myself, do you know what? I can't be keep hurting my mom in order to do something against like FGM. I need to quit. And then I met you, and then I quit. Like, and I was doing like girl guided stuff.
So is this the point where you said you like allowed yourself to fall apart?
Yeah, because I just thought I'm just gonna like.
So this was your fifth point, actually. So you've kind of segued into this. So go on.
So I just like literally allowed myself to like, this is not my, like, you know, I was like literally just like broken and just like crying all the time. I ended up like, it had to be like, I thought, you know, what is the thing that I can do? I need to face my fears. So like, one of my fears was the fact that I needed to go back to Somaliland because I thought, I'm never going to be accepted. It's like, and also at the same time, I thought I would turn up in Somaliland and be kidnapped and killed because I'd brought shame to my family. But instead, what happened was that my grandma gave me an exorcism. I was like, oh my God.
But hang on. Wait, your grandma gave me...
So I had, in 2013, the first exorcism I had was in Southall. Of all places.
Yeah.
And this guy was like, he read the Quran.
So what? Why was this happening? The exorcism.
So my mom, because I had to be possessed to be going on television and doing.
Oh, things. I see. Okay.
About my vagina. I gave up my job, and this is all I was doing was like shaming myself.
Your mum thought that you needed to have an exorcism because you were being so
radical.
Radical.
Therefore, I had to be mentally ill or possessed.
And you went along with it. You were like, yeah, okay, let's do this.
Yeah, because do you know what? That's the thing. Like, I love her, so I will entertain her in these kind of situations. And then the guy's like, and then this is the thing. It's like, he has this kind of pot, which has like, it's like really like strong thing. I think it's opium. So mm-hmm. he puts it under your nose and he's like, smell it. And if you sniff that, you're gonna get lightheaded. So it's technically trying to give me poppers without giving me poppers.
So where does this guy, what is he? The guy who does it?
He's a Somali guy that reads the Quran on you with a microphone. Starts off with mic check 1, 2. He just reads verses of the Quran which have been known to get rid of demons.
Right. Okay.
So I was like, yeah, whatever. And then he basically gave everybody, I said I felt nothing. And he's like, what, even not lightheaded? And I was like, no. And then my mum's like, I was tingling. And I was like, because my mum loves all that stuff. So I was like, of course. Right. And then we go. And then he says, well, I want you to stay back. And I was like, there is no way I'm staying back on my own view. I watch undercover shows of what you And then he said to my mom, he called my mom and he said she has to come back, like, you know, alone.
Yeah.
Without any nail polish, because I think the nail polish was blocking the words. And I said, like, because that's me. I was like, no, he wants to, like, rape me or abuse me.
Yeah.
On my own. And mom was like, see, look, you are demented. Why would you say that about a holy man? I'm like, because I know what they're like. They're like disgusting weirdos. So obviously I didn't go back. And then when I went to Somaliland in 2016, actually I went on May 17th to be there for May 18th, which is the Independence Day. So I thought, you know what, make it all cliche. This is the first time I'm going to go.
Yeah.
And the last time. And then I loved it so much. I went back in. I went back in like the Christmas, like post Brexit. So that was May. Then I came back. Mm. Brexit happened. And I was like, "Fuck this shit! I need to go back to somewhere else." And then I went back in 2016, to end 2016. So I was there for New Year's into 2017.
Right.
And it was like, and it was so interesting. But that, like, you know, that I kind of, again, I forget the privilege that I have of the fact that in Somaliland, we are the 1%. Like, my family's name is known and all that.
Right.
Stuff. I could really just, like, fit in. I think there's a tendency to assume that all Black people, all Africans or Black people that have come to this country have come from a position of deprivation. And even if they are living in places where there is poverty, they still carry with them privileges which you can't see, which would allow from one generation to go from refugees raised by a single mother to be able to hold court with the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
So let's go on to your sixth point. The sixth moment that made you was when you got your OBE.
Yeah.
And what did that mean to you?
To be honest, I just put that in because I wanted some positive shit in it. It was nice. It was actually nice to take my niece and my little cousin and my sister to the palace. And a really weird thing happened, which my cousin, he's 13 now, commented on it. Like, you get these little blue cards and on it says, bring ID. And obviously, it's Limka Ali, so she's like, doesn't tell anybody and doesn't even bring her own ID.
Right.
So then I was like, oh shit. And then I go to the guard and I said, oh my God, I'm so sorry, but we forgot to bring our ID. And he's like, what? And he was a police officer. And he was like, oh, Nimco Ali. And I was like, yeah. And he said, oh, I read about you, mom. So I know who you are, so you can come in. And then my little cousin, who's 13, was like, they just let 4 Muslims in without any ID into Buckingham Palace. This is what happens when you're a Z-list celebrity. And then all the other people, all the English people, because it's their country and because they're so obedient, were all like there with their what's it called?
Passports.
Passports. But I think that's one of my knacks, is like, I just have a way of, my sister always says, getting away with shit.
Right.
Like, you can walk into Buckingham Palace without a bloody badge, like, without any ID, like.
And what do you think that is? What do you think it is that gets you can get, that makes you get away with things?
I don't know. Do you know what? It's because, you know, I'm really, I never want to hurt anybody, so I will never use it in order to have unfair advantage. And also, it's just because I think I'm cheeky.
I think you're also really charming. In an unconventional way. And I think that's, you know, one of the ways that you've managed to get so much stuff done, right? for FGM is because you're really good at like getting on with people, getting people, persuading people to do things that you want. I've seen you like at events and parties. You're like a really excellent socializer, which is like really good to be able to do.
Yeah, I'm very like, I've got good chat. I can kind of like have those kind of conversations. So it's kind of cheeky because people will say what do you mean you're here to talk about vaginas? Like, what, like people will say to me in a really serious place, like, what do you do? And I was like, I talk about vaginas.
But maybe that's refreshing because actually it's so boring to have small talk all the time. And you go straight to medium talk, as Larry David would say. Like,
you
get to it. Like, you're not like, ah, yeah, the weather. You're like, hey, how's your vagina? Or something like that, which I think, although British people are not supposed to enjoy that, actually, I think it's quite refreshing.
It is, especially if you do it in a way which is like kind of humorous and not like, I'm here to tell you about FGM, blah, blah, whatever. Yeah. And then one of my friends says to me, he says, why do you always ask people what they do? And I think because I want to contextualize things. It's like, I want to have conversations around, like, I do have a broad general knowledge so I can talk about kind of things. And then I remember when I was like trying to date, and I think it's one of the things that I used to say to people as a joke, what do you think about the situation in Chechnya? And people would look at me like, what is Tiger Tiger?
Just two quick questions about moments that have made you. Can you tell me what like your happiest, when you go to a memory of like the happiest moment or like a purely happy moment, what would that be?
Do you know what's really, really sad? I don't, like, somebody said that to me the other day, like, what was your childhood like? And I said, actually quite traumatic. Like, so I don't have.
Or a recent one, like just doing something that was really fun and that you just, you know, like once in a while you get a moment where you're like, oh, this is, you know, it doesn't get much better than this kind of thing.
Well, do you know what? I hadn't seen the kids and the family for like a while, like obviously during the COVID lockdown. So seeing my niece and seeing my little cousin and just like allowing them to be like children in my house was quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was something that I've always like, it was really because we were talking about time we spend with each other. And I said, the two boys who are 17 and 13, I said, I used to take them to the park all the time. I would take them from Edgware all the way to Hyde Park and all these things. I said, it's because I had time. And the girls, it's been completely different in the sense that I just kind of had like shorter moments with them. So it's just actually having time with them again, that was lovely. And because also like a lot of the work that I do and a lot of the stuff that we do is so unpaid, I'm going to be very like shallow, and getting paid recently was quite nice.
I think that's a really important point to make. And actually, I've been asking people about money on this podcast because women don't talk about money enough. And actually, how do you get paid when you're an activist? Like, where do you get money from?
Exactly. Like, what I, like, you know what? It's like the stuff I do in a job description is like multi, like, you know, I see job descriptions for what I do every day, but nobody wants to pay me for what I do. So it's just like, it's quite depressing. So yeah, getting paid, I think that's been nice, having some financial security. I think seeing the kids for the first time since COVID has been a really happy moment, and also having some money in the bank.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. This podcast was edited by Lauren Lind, and it was all brought to you by The Female Lead. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you. See you next time.